Okay, let's look at some other matters now. Relational sex outside the commitment of marriage. Number 2353 reads of the Catechism, fornication is carnal union between an unmarried man and an unmarried woman. So we've left ancient Jewish definition behind. It is gravely contrary to the dignity of persons and of human sexuality, which is naturally ordered to the good of spouses and the generation and education of children. They talk about in 2390 the living together, people living together unmarried. I'll keep going though. 2391 is a statement on trial marriage in the Catechism. Jack Dominion, whom I find the most enlightened writer, is an English psychiatrist on all these matters. So if you want to read a good Catholic author in touch with the tradition that talks sensibly, you have to go a long way, I have to tell you. But and leave us clerics out of it. Go to Jack Dominion. He's excellent, in my view. Well, he's, see what you like with this. He says in his book called The Growth of Love and Sex, he writes, it's natural for young people to wish to meet, enjoy each other's company, receive pleasure and joy from their bodies with some inevitable genital tension. But this tension is not to be a prelude to sexual intercourse. Sexual intercourse is not a part of this adolescent discovery. It's clearly the seal of a love between two people who've reached the stage of life commitment and are ready to raise children in the permanent union which we call marriage. Our culture doesn't teach that. I would think it's eminently wise, and you will have your own life experience to form your own opinion on it. He goes on to say, for sexual intercourse to be fully human, then has to be a union of affection and genital sex. Affection means the presence of trust, security, and knowledge of feeling recognized, wanted, and appreciated, and the possibility of continuity and reliability. These aspects of affection grow as a relationship deepens and finally meet in a permanent commitment we call marriage. Number 2350 of the Catechism reads, those who are engaged to marry are called to live chastely in continence. They should see in this time of testing a discovery of mutual respect, an apprenticeship in fidelity, and the hope of receiving one another from God. They should reserve for marriage the expressions of affection that belong to married love. They will help each other grow in chastity. No one's pretending any of that's easy, and there's a journey there. But that's the Church's teaching, and nothing I've ever learnt would make me think it's unwise. So you make up your own experience on it. But if it's true, we need a lot of help to give to our young people, because everything else is saying the contrary to them. And the number of young people who are hurt because of sexual engagements without commitment is nearly infinite. So, relational sex with commitment. Human sexuality, these are my thoughts, so treat them however you wish. Human sexuality is meant to be relational and unitive. The dynamic of relational sex is always towards love and commitment. The dynamic of commitment is towards a relationship that is exclusive and permanent. Human procreation is fully responsible only in such a relationship. Society protects this crucial relationship by the institution called marriage. Marriage union unto death is the highest ideal and goal of Christian marriage. It's a sacrament to the spouses, to their children, to the world, of the unchanging, eternal, faithful love of God as revealed in Jesus. So I sum up this with 3 points, to best of my knowledge. Firstly, to give oneself to another person in genital sexual union is appropriate only where there's genuine mutual love. I don't think anyone that I've ever met, young or old, would disagree with that. It's about, and that's what people want. The boys want it, the girls want it. That's what we're looking for. Genuine, mutual love. Some today, I suppose the generality today, stop at that point and think, well, if as long as you love the other person, you're not hurting anybody, you're not telling them lies, it's okay to have a sexual union with them. They learn later that that's not actually the way it works, but they often think that. So I think there's a second point that needs to be made, and I offer it to you for your thought. The nature of genital sexual love requires commitment. There's an extra element. It's not just that you're loving and you really feel for them and you care, you're actually committed to them. I think there's more to it than that too, but I think that's critical, psychologically and in fact. Though it's possible to take measures to ensure that conception does not take place, genital sexual union of its nature, you just have to look at what happens to know this, is clearly in view of conception. The man is giving his seed to the woman so that the egg and the seed will fertilise, the possibility, and so it's about giving life and openness to the fruit of love. It therefore requires the kind of committed love that is the foundation of marriage, parenting and family. I suggest there's a third point that needs saying. Sexual partnership and parenting are not simply individual matters, and we live in a culture that's very individualistic. It's no one else's business, it's just between us. No culture in the world believes that. The most primitive cultures protect sexual union vigorously, for a whole lot of reasons, but they've got taboos and in covering them, so every human being knows that there's more to the that sexual union, marriage, is critical to the tribe, to the whole culture. So let's get to that aspect. It profoundly concerns society. It is appropriate that the mutual commitment be celebrated in community. Then the living together enjoys the support of the community. It's a gift to the community. It witnesses to the kind of commitment needed for a faithful loving, for the raising of a family. And in a Christian context, marriage is a sacrament, a sign to the couple and to others of God's faithful love. And once it's celebrated, looking at it now, speaking as a Catholic priest, once it's celebrated in the church, everybody relaxes because they know what's happened and they enjoy it and they, you know, well, it does something, it bonds the whole community. So that's my summary. The last thing I'll say today will be very important, but I'll just continue now. Let's look at the question of artificial birth control, because that's had a big effect on this whole issue. Firstly, the Catechism, 2366 in the second edition. So this was a change from the first edition. A child springs from the heart of the mutual love-giving of spouses as its fruit and fulfilment. So the Church teaches that, and now we're quoting Pope Paul VI in that famous encyclical Humanae Vitae, 1968. It is necessary that each and every marriage act remain ordered per se of itself to the procreation of human life. That was the statement made in that encyclical. The Catechism continues, 2370, every action which, whether in anticipation of the conjugal act or in its accomplishment, proposes, whether as an end or as a means, to render procreation impossible, is intrinsically evil. In other words, not just your intention, but of itself, it's the wrong thing to do, objectively, says the Catechism. That needs some unpacking, I think. So I offer you now for your knowledge a couple of facts. The consultation that came prior to the encyclical Humanae Vitae is interesting. Now, the encyclical is the final result of all that, the papal statement, but there was a consultation, and this is the facts about that. In his biography of Pope Paul VI, Peter Hebblethwaite reproduces a summary by Patrick and Patricia Crowley from Chicago of a survey of 3,000 devout Catholic couples from 18 countries on the rhythm method, which was the one that the Church permitted because it didn't positively interfered. It timed the relationship. And they were looking into it now. I remember one of my brothers telling me it depended whether on the moonrise and the sunset and the tides and they had seven kids, so it wasn't all that successful in their case. But they've got beautiful children and life's gone on. Okay, but he used to sometimes think it was a bit tough waiting for the tide. These are the questions surveyed to that 3,000 devout Catholic couples. We're not talking about a random sample, people who really... Okay. Does rhythm have a bad psychological effect? Almost without exception, the responses were, yes, it does. It may not have been your experience if you did this, but they mostly said, yes, it's not. I think my brother would have perfectly agreed with that. By the way, he said he'd never ask his children to do it. And he's a very saintly man. Second, does rhythm serve any useful purpose? A few say it can help develop discipline. Nobody says it fosters married love. Does rhythm contribute to married unity? No, was the answer. Instead of love, rhythm tends to substitute tension, dissatisfaction, frustration, and disunity. Is rhythm unnatural? The answer was yes. The physical and psychological implications of rhythm are not understood by the male church. Consult the laity at your own risk. Now, at the meeting of the commission, now you've got the clergy coming in on this commission, you've got cardinals and all the good people. On the 3rd of June 1966, the bishops and theologians agreed with the results of the survey. And this was what they produced. Is contraception intrinsically evil? And they said, no, it's not. Remember, the Pope said it was. Later said it was, but they said it wasn't. Is the encyclical of Pope Pius XI, Custi Connubii, which was a statement made by Pius XI in 1930, it spoke against artificial birth control. Is it irreformable? And they said, no, it's not. These are theologians and cardinals talking. No, it's not. The popes can make mistakes and situations change, you see. Medicine changes. So you've got to keep alert. Is the church in a state of doubt? And these all people honestly said, yes, it is. Could the church change its position? And they said, yes. So all that went to the Pope. The report of the commission was leaked and published by National Catholic Reporter on the 16th of April 1977 and by the Tablet on the 22nd of April. So that was meant to be a confidential thing, but it became public in 1967. The World Congress of the Laity in 1967 included the following in its conclusions. There's a very clear feeling among Christian lay people that there is need for a clear stand by the teaching authorities of the Church which would focus on fundamental moral and spiritual values while leaving the choice of scientific means for achieving responsible parenthood to parents acting with their Christian faith and on the basis of medical and scientific consultation. With that background... I have to go. Thank you. With that background, however, the Pope chose, inspired by God, who knows, but he chose to write the encyclical, which actually went against the advice that he was given. That doesn't mean he was wrong or right, but he did that. After the encyclical, 1968, now we're back to 1974, the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith used to be called the Propaganda... what was it called?
Inquisition.
Yes, the Inquisition. Oh, you would bring that up. gave the following reply to questions concerning Humanae Vitae. So now you're at a top-level official reply back, and it read like this. In Humanae Vitae, contraception is condemned as intrinsically illicit. This doctrine is an authentic expression of the pontifical magisterium, which must be acknowledged with reverence and sincerely adhered to. There can, however, be situations in which a couple have, in good faith, come to the erroneous conviction, so they're not disagreeing with the Pope, the erroneous conviction that in their particular case the use of contraceptives is justified. In this case, the use of contraceptives, although objectively unlawful, is subjectively excusable on condition that the judgment of conscience is made on the basis of sufficient information and after serious reflection before God. This is traditional Catholic doctrine on personal conscience as the norm for responsible human action, and was applied to contraception by the magisterium of various episcopates and of the Holy See itself in the decision in the Washington case, which I'm not giving you, but you can look it up if you want to on the internet, of the 26th of April 1971. So there's an acknowledgement of the place of conscience in this whole area, though it restates the objective correctness in the view of these people of the papal statement. The Australian Catholic bishops, I'll conclude with this, conference in its pastoral letter on Humanae Vitae in 1974 offered the following reflection. It's very good, I think. See what you think of it. It is not impossible, however, having stated the statement, it is not impossible, however, that an individual may fully accept the teaching authority of the Pope in general, may be aware of his teaching in this matter, and yet reach a position, after honest study and prayer, that is at variance with the papal teaching. Such a person could be without blame. He would certainly not have cut himself off from the Church, and in acting in accordance with his conscience, he would be without subjective fault. That's as much as I want to go into that matter with you, but I hope I've alerted you to the fact that there's a bit of grey in this whole area, and leave it at that. It's not an infallible statement from the Pope, so it could be wrong, obviously, by definition, and there'd be many people who say it is, and so on. So we're in an area of discovery, and we have to be very careful with ourselves and with others. To go on now to a different topic, the Catechism lists a number of ways in which we can fail to live chastely. It speaks of 2376, of donation of sperm and ovum, of providing a surrogate uterus as gravely immoral. It's not talking about a husband producing sperm and a wife producing an egg, which then can be brought, helped to come together in a test tube or whatever, IVF, and then replaced in the womb. That can assist the love-giving. And there are other qualifications that have to come into that. But that itself is not wrong, obviously, to be helped if there's some physical or whatever problem in either side to achieve procreation and they really want a child. Well, then, technically speaking, the in vitro fertilization is not itself wrong. There are ways of doing it that lead to other complications, which I won't go into now and let you do yourself. Techniques involving only the married couple, says 2376, are perhaps less reprehensible, yet remain morally unacceptable. They dissociate the sexual act from the procreative act. That's what the Catechism says. Very good moral theologians disagree. I've just given you their opinion. And so I think there's areas there that need further reflection. I don't want to delay on any of this because I want to get on to something more important in a minute. Pornography consists in removing real or stimulated sexual acts from the intimacy of the partners in order to display them deliberately to third parties. It is a grave offence. We'd all agree. Prostitution reduces the person to an instrument of sexual pleasure. While it's always gravely sinful to engage in prostitution, the imputability of the offence can be attenuated by destitution, blackmail, or social pressure. Be careful who we blame for this phenomenon. Rape is a forcible violation of sexual intimacy of another person. It's always an intrinsically evil act. The Catechism talks about adultery, polygamy, incest, and sexual abuse. And you'd expect to talk about those things. Polygamy is a cultural thing, of course. So one has to be very culturally aware in that area. Now I conclude with this, I think, very good statement by a very good writer Another very good author on moral issues is Dick Westley, and he's written a book a number of years ago, 1984, called Morality and Its Beyond, and I think this is a very good statement on the sixth commandment, for to my way of thinking. To those engaged in non-relational fun and games sex, Christians should uphold the ideal of relational, caring and concerned sex. He's more or less saying, and isn't this true? We're not supposed to, who am I to be pouncing on someone else because of their behaviour? Doesn't seem to be what Jesus ever did. But doesn't mean do nothing. It means attract people who are in a bit of a messy situation to the next step of love. So if they are engaged, and people are, in this kind of sexual relationship, then it says here, he says, we should be, mums, dads, priests, pulpits, upholding that there's something better and something more engaging, more beautiful, more real for you, and attract them to it. Just like our earlier discussion about war, in one way, we have to be saying to our society as it goes berserk in this defending itself, Star Wars style, wait a minute, what on earth are you doing? And we have to be very courageous and straightforward in putting other values. So, now, he goes to the next step. To those engaged in relational sex, but unable to commit themselves, Christians are to uphold the ideal of relational sex, which is, in addition, committed. So, and in a sense, everyone wants this deep down, so let's keep it alive for them. To those who've arrived at a sex life that is both relational and committed, the Christian community should uphold the ideal of openness to new life, whether through procreation or selfless service of others. Some people, for whatever reason, can't have children, and they may wish to and proceed along that path, or they may, as many people you know and I know have done, as a married couple, they've given themselves through adoption, perhaps, or through public service, or they've actually committed their lives to a very life-giving, love-giving. Sad that they aren't able to have children, but they've given themselves in a very loving way. So we should uphold that ideal. And to those who are already incarnating in their life these ideals, we should uphold the highest Christian ideal, that of a special relationship that bespeaks the presence and fidelity of God and transforms human love and intimacy into a sacrament. Keep alive what this sacrament of marriage is. And I know married couples, you do too, that are a wonderful sacrament to the me. They help me in my celibate life too, immensely, and to the world of welcoming, loving relationship that is just a sacrament, a clear sign of something immensely beautiful. Not all can reach that goal, and often because it takes two of them to do it, and one may not, and so again, as in every life, we can't organise success. But when you see it happening, so Westley goes on, and so, wherever people are struggling with the tremendous ambiguities of human love and intimacy, let's at least recognise that. The church should be upholding the ideal appropriate to the level they are on. That is just so vital. And so present it as a gift that may be either freely accepted or rejected. Freedom is at the heart of what we're doing as, and we're always having to check everything, whether we're using pressure on people or whether we're upholding, like Jesus did, or as Jesus did, a free choice that attracts them to something more beautiful than they're now experiencing. And I've used this image before, pardon me if I use it again, but I just think, it occurred to me years ago, and is the story of the prodigal son, which we all love. And I have to be careful, of course, and I presume I fail as often as everybody else, but if somebody's in a situation that's messy, hurtful to others, sinful, objectively dysfunctional, we can't say anything till we know where they were 5 minutes ago. And the prodigal son in the middle of the garden, all in a total mess, he may have walked halfway to the fence in heroic ways that I've never done, because I've never had the difficulty of having to do it. And I'm outside here because of mum and dad and whatever training and all that, maybe. And I look and I say, look, you're in a mess. Well, he is in a mess because he's still in the pig yard, but he's there. He's come from there. And if I tell him he's wrong and pound at him that he's wrong, and some people seem to get joy out of doing that, pound that he's wrong, all I'm doing to that bloke is or woman, they're likely to say, well, what's the point? And they're likely to go back to the middle of the yard again. Whereas if you knew them the way Jesus knew the woman who was caught in adultery, or Mary of Magdala, or the leper, or Peter, or Judas, whom he hugged in the garden, if we actually knew the person, our proper reaction would probably be, wow, you're terrific. God, how do you do it? They are in a mess. They haven't got out of the mess yet, do you get me? But they've heroically journeyed from there to there. And if God knows, I mightn't. So shouldn't our attitude always be one of welcoming, wonder, humility, offering? Or as Dick Wesley sees here, if a person was there and thought it was the fence, I could only do them a favour by saying, oh no, look, hang on, that's terrific what's happened, but actually if this could even be more beautiful for you. Oh, do you know what I mean? Share it as a gift, as he says, to be accepted or rejected. We don't intrude on other people's freedom. And Dick Wesley concludes, and I conclude, the church should do all this without a word about the dire consequences of rejecting so noble and good a gift. And we all fell into that mistake, me more than you, because I'm a priest and I had to preach when I was 25 and give the church's teaching on every issue. So I'm sure, and I think I still make the mistake. I have to keep reminding. You know, if you don't go to Mass on Sunday, it's a mortal sin, I think. You know, saying that is telling people the dire consequences of their not coming. It's not helpful. It's not true. So we've got to back off all this dire consequence stuff without denying the consequences of people's behaviour. And Jesus talked about hell, so what's wrong with me talking about it? But not as a threat, but as a warning. Don't go too near the cliff, you'll fall over. Back to Wesley. The church should do all this without a word about the dire consequences of rejecting so noble and good a gift. In short, the church should be truly pastoral about it all. Threats are particularly ungracious, and they transform the Christian enterprise into something akin to blackmail. This is a terrible way to go about witnessing to God in the world. An additional reason why threats are unnecessary is that life has a way of teaching the lessons of love and intimacy to those who frustrate the dynamic of relational love and relational sex. Failure to follow the built-in dynamic of those realities is bound to bring great suffering to oneself and to others. The appropriate Christian response to people in that predicament is not threats or inflicting more pain, but loving compassion as the Lord would give it graciously. We must never lose sight of the ideal. That's very important and never more important than today. We must never lose sight of the ideal, nor fail to uphold it for our world in the Lord's name. But we must never lose sight of the fact that it is an ideal to be courageously striven for. As Christians, we're also called to deal much more compassionately with those who, for whatever reason, fail to achieve it. To do the first without the second makes us a countersign of, rather than a witness to,